Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So yesterday evening, about 6 o'clock, a Chicago police officer was shot in West Inglewood. She was driving the squad car. Her partner took her to the hospital, where she was at least last night reported in critical but stable condition.
Yeah, her condition improved, so now she's in stable. But it was
so I'm a little confused on what happened here first. According to the superintendent there, David Brown. They're
making a traffic stop at 61st and Polina.
Right. And they were attempting to stop the vehicle they were attempting to stop first sped off, then came back around and slowed down so they could pull up parallel to the officer's car, at which point they opened fire.
I mean, think about it. They hunted them down. They turned around and they slowly moved up. So they're right point blank range. Right to her face and to her body. I mean, this is the wild, wild west. And this was only a mile away from where Ella French was gunned down.
Yeah, and right near partner. The 7th District Station, too. Is there something that's confusing to you about that description of what happened? The car they were attempting to stop at first sped off, then came back around and slowed down so they could pull up parallel to the officer's car, at which point they open fire.
That reeks of a lack of respect for police.
That's not it. Well, I mean, that's it, obviously. But
who's running the streets there? Well, the gangbangers.
There's nothing about that description that presents any questions to you. Let me try this again.
They couldn't chase after them because of the stupid laws that are in place by Lightfoot.
Now we're getting there. Yeah. We're attempting to stop, sped off, then came back around, slowed down so they could pull up to the officer's car. So they were attempting a traffic stop. They stopped pursuing the car after it sped off. Then that car came back around to essentially chase the police car, pulling up alongside, and then opening fire.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
That's the commentary on policing under these civilian authorities in Chicago. They couldn't make a traffic stop in the most violent neighborhood in Chicago, and the criminals obviously know that, so unimpressed and unintimidated by police that they'll come back and chase police and then open fire. In Inglewood so far this year, according to HeyJackass.com, 19 homicides, 86 gunshot victims, total of 105. 86. That's the only neighborhood in triple digits right now in terms of gunshot victims and dead in the city. But there will be others. I mean, you know, it is only the beginning of June. Here's some of the residents of Inglewood commenting on what happened last night.
You kill my future. This got to stop. This gun stop got to stop. This is a wake-up call for us. It's time for us to stand up with the police officers and start walking and helping these police officers. Everybody got to just stop this violence. Stop it.
Well, those are encouraging comments from that young woman who apparently lives in the neighborhood. If only I believed that this is a wake-up call. If only I believed that local pastor offering the same commiseration with police, encouraging.
I'm very concerned about the children here in Inglewood and the police officers getting shot and killed. Hey, man, you know, it's so sad.
Mm-hmm. It is. But the story to me is about how cops are sitting ducks.
Right. And why weren't they chasing them? What are the rules? I know you can't do foot chases because of what happened with those two kids.
Well, can you or can't you? I don't know.
But that's the thing. They keep changing the rules. Can you pursue in your vehicle? Can you do a high-speed police chase? No, they don't want to do that. That doesn't mean that would have been a high-speed police chase. I mean, later that car crashed at 64th and Bishop, and all three of the suspects got out and are still on the loose.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Mayor Triple Threat tweeted out on the subject, "I'm aware of the officer who was shot in the 7th District, have been in constant communication with Superintendent Brown since this outrageous attack on our offices occurred. We're praying for the injured officer and the entire department as they grapple with yet another heinous and deliberate assault on our officers' lives. Use every possible resource to find the person responsible for this attempted murder of a police officer and bring them to justice." What does that look like? What does bringing them to justice look like? Electronic monitoring?
Where they get 48 hours off a week?
Officers and detectives are hard at work on this urgent mission. I urge all Chicagoans to remember the selfless sacrifice that police officers make every day for our safety, even though they are a systemically racist institution. That was my parenthetical remark. But do you see the problem with all of this? The saying one thing and doing another, saying one thing and then saying another. Everything is in contradiction with itself because it's all based on political expediency and feelings. So an officer is shot in the line of duty and it's thoughts and prayers and let's remember the great job police do. This is the same woman who imposed a consent decree in the police, the same woman who was touting the Black Lives Matter mantra about police pre her mayoralty and including the time that she's been mayor. This is a woman who conflates the rare instance of inappropriate use of force by police, particularly deadly force, as compared to what's happening on the streets of Chicago. For example, so far this year, police-involved shootings, one person has been killed, seven have been wounded in police-involved shootings. And I'm not aware of any that are in controversy. At least legitimately.
Well, the 13-year-old at the gas station.
Legitimately in controversy. Yeah. Legitimately in controversy. You can make a controversy about anything. Legitimately. One and seven. By contrast, on the streets of Chicago so far this year, 254 homicides and 1,237 people shot. So again, can you tell me what the order of magnitude is here? And can you compare the order of magnitude according to the numbers, according to the body count? Compare that to the rhetoric that attempts to conflate these issues and suggest that the threats are similar, if actually the threat from police is not more pronounced the way that this is discussed.
And maybe the police officers were afraid to pursue them because if, you know, there's a wrong shot, they could get sued, they could get fired, they could go to jail. I mean, it's hard to be a police officer. That's why no one's applying. They had four people show up to one event for recruits. Four. So now they've opened it up online.
I understand what's happening, but when you're on the job, then you're on the job.
Right. Well, you've got to do your job, and you've sworn an oath to do that.
And you've also, you know, got to protect yourself. I mean, the pat police line of, you know, I have a right to go home to my family. Yeah, right. So you may want to, gather together with your fellow officers, maybe your immediate superiors that don't work on the fifth floor at City Hall, and say in the water in Inglewood, then we got a problem. Because if I have a reasonable suspicion, if somebody committed an offense and I need to stop them, or I have a reasonable suspicion that there's nefarious activity going on and I make a traffic stop, then I am making the traffic stop. I'm going to be in charge. I am going to be the person on offense for the purpose of public safety, the purpose of, you know, maintaining law and order. I'm not going to give chase, stop, send the signal that you can do whatever you want, and then have to have my head on a, and my, me and my partner have to have our head on a swivel when we're patrolling the streets, or much less on foot. Craig in Mount Greenwood, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan. Good morning, Dan, and good morning, Amy, and thank you for taking my call. You've been right on all these points you're making, everything. These leftist people that are in charge of our city and that, they've been working on doing this to create this type of environment. And just for an example, I mean, it was a while back there, the whole thing about even just pulling their gun out of their holster, walking up on the seat, being in a rough area and just having their gun out of their holster in their hand so they're ready to protect themselves. No, no. They got to have a gun pointed at them first and everything. That put themselves at a disadvantage. The no chasing, it's on and on and on. They do everything they can to take and protect the criminal and put the police at a disadvantage. It's insane, but they're doing it purposely to destroy our society.
Thanks for the call, Craig. You know, we talked to Professor Richard Epstein, the great economics and law professor, University of Chicago now, the other day about gun control, but he mentioned stop and frisk, which per the Supreme Court's Terry decision has been upheld as constitutional. But it's not part of approved policing in Chicago. But we get thoughts and prayers from Triple Threat when another officer is shot in the line of duty. You know, by the way, we have the FOP present playing Republican primary politics, which we'll talk about after the news. John Canzara is out playing Republican Party politics in the suburbs when he should be beating the drum for the sort of policing tools that officers need to keep themselves and Chicago residents safe. And it should be relentless, as relentless as the left is in undermining police and law and order.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So tonight is another Republican gubernatorial debate, this time ABC7. And this time, at least you'll have, and I won't say it's going to be a debate because these things are never really debates in the way they should be, but at least you'll have
all the candidates on the same stage.
Well, and the two front runners side by side, meaning Irvin and Bailey.
Yeah, and it starts at 6 o'clock. You can watch it if you have cable on channel 7.2, whatever that is. And it's going to last an hour long. And Alan Krzyzewski is going to be in charge. Craig Wall will be asking questions, and then two from Univision.
Yeah. So yesterday, trying to burnish his law enforcement credentials, given the fact that he's a self-professed enthusiastic supporter of Black Lives Matter, Richard Irvin had a little press conference that you attended.
Oh, yeah. He was there with the Durkin. He was there with the Kendall County Sheriff, with his lieutenant governor candidate. On the wall when you walk in, hashtag Blue Lives Matter. It was so staged, so creepy. But this is what, you know, he wants to do if he becomes governor. Of course, get rid of House Bill 3653.
The anti-police, pro-criminal policies. That means keeping cash bail for violent criminals. Banning anonymous complaints against police officers to ruin their careers. Restoring felony murder to hold killers accountable. Stop allowing dangerous criminals to skip their electronic monitoring for 48 hours.
And of course, he ripped on Kim Fox, But he wouldn't say her name, you know, kind of exactly like our Democratic overlords do. David Brown, Mayor Lightfoot.
Fortunately, we have a state's attorney who refuses to do the job and actually prosecute criminals.
You know, I'll get reaction to Richard Irvin. Maybe I can bait somebody in. Anybody out there who's not bought and paid for supporting Richard Irvin?
Please. We'd love to hear from you.
Make an argument. Can you, I mean, he repeated the talking points from FOP perfectly. Does he get credit for that? Maybe that's a reason he should be the Republican nominee. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. I know it's a groundswell. At least that's what they'd have you believe. Groundswell of support for Richard Irvin. That's why Ken Griffin said $45 million isn't enough. I'll throw in another five because it's going so well. But tell us. Make the case. Anybody.
Please. I mean, this man is uncomfortable in his own skin. He gets up there, Dan, you're going to love this, and says, Aurora is the safest city in Illinois. No, it's not since you've been the mayor. Well, since he's been mayor, sexual assaults up 19%, arson up 60%, homicides up 80%. It's not the safest city. But they just make these declarative statements like everything's great. And look at what I've accomplished as mayor.
So the big talk about repealing the anti-police legislation that was passed and signed into law by Democrat socialists.
Oh, yeah.
He was the mayor of Aurora last year.
Right.
Did he say anything then?
No, he didn't.
Why not?
Because he loves Pritzker. He had Pritzker over in Aurora in August of 2021 to talk about the Foyd card and its accomplishments and how they're improving the system. Because he wants to keep the Foyd card process in place. And this is what he said when he was pressed about that. You know, why? But you were hand in hand with Pritzker on this.
Those Foyd card changes were, you know, that Pritzker talked about was not enough to go beyond what we need to address those issues. It's broken, needs to be fixed, and when I'm governor, I'll fix it.
You know, that's the same thing he said at the debate last week about Foyd cards, asked whether or not he would support getting rid of Foyd cards.
And I saw as the drones went overhead, as, you know, things on fire, police cars on fire, my downtown just on fire and people running around destroying things. You know, I was conflicted.
Yeah, that's not it. This is it. Sorry.
The Foyd card system in Illinois is broken. You know, I can say, you know, specifically my Foyd card expired during COVID. It took me a year to get another one. The system's broken and definitely needs to be fixed. But we need background checks to ensure that guns don't get into the hands of criminals and folks with mental illnesses and make it harder for us to protect our residents.
And I'm just
so here's the thing. Here's how little this guy knows. Here's what a grifter he is. Are you listening? You heard him say at that the same thing yesterday that he said at that debate. So he supports keeping the Foyd card. How many states have a Foyd card? Does he know? Anybody ask him? All those enterprising reporters there? No, of course not.
He won't take questions from reporters.
Okay.
Just a select few.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
And then he runs away. I'm so mad I spent $53 on parking for that.
Does he make an argument?
No.
No, he says everything's broken and needs to be fixed, but I support background checks. It's the buzz phrases of your political hack, of your grifter. Remarkable. I mean, I understand that there are the Republican quislings, those that are just interested in protecting their piece of turf and those that are satellites around them who feed off of them. So the Durkins and the other surrender Republicans that have, until recently when the Democrat Socialist Party became completely socialist, had worse voting records on many of these issues than certainly Southern Democrats, somebody like Durkin, who, by the way, has historically like DNF ratings from the NRA. And he's your House Republican leader in Illinois. You wonder why things are going so well. So Foyd cards.
Okay.
Simple thing. How many states have a Foyd card? Does anybody know?
I think three.
I know. Four.
Well, I was close.
Hawaii, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and us. and we need background checks. Do you understand how the purchasing a gun works, Mr. Former Prosecutor? So 46 states don't have background checks? Is that what you're saying?
They do.
46 states don't care about their people. They're not interested in preventing gun crime, even though they do a much better job than, say, Illinois does, including Aurora. So what is your, and I hope this comes up in the debate, and
I hope
some of these other candidates have the wherewithal to just freeze, because it's illustrative of so many other things. What is it you're saying exactly, Mr. Mayor? So we say we need background checks. What do you mean?
We already have background checks.
So the FOIA card is the background check? No, it's not. How do 46 other states do background checks for people who buy guns? They don't have FOIA cards. So they don't have background checks? So which is it? Explain to me how the world works, Mayor Irvin, because you're an expert. You're a former prosecutor. We hear this, how briefly that was. And you're mayor, and this and that, and you want to be governor. So explain to us how it works.
I love what, because Marian Ahern interviewed Bailey and Sullivan, and this was lost on everybody yesterday.
When the riots broke out in Aurora, he told his police to stand down, and nobody's talking about that.
Yeah, safe city, uh-huh. Well, he was the leader of the police department, and that's what he decided to do. And he enthusiastically supported Black Lives Matter, and their mantra is to defund police. And yesterday was all about, we need to fund police. So where do you stand? Will you try to ask that question? No. Only question I got in was because the parental notification ended yesterday. And I said, if you're governor, would you reinstate it and why? And he said, uncomfortably, yes. And then he runs away. While other people had other questions. Because he is worse than Governor Pritzker. I am telling you, when it comes to taking questions from the media and actually responding. Because he doesn't have a response. Because he's uncomfortable in his own skin, and he is not ready for this job. And most importantly, he's not a Democrat. So we were very surprised to see John Catanzara there supporting Mr. Mayor.
Violent. We can take back this state, and it starts June 28th.
Well, weren't you surprised that John Catanzara and the FOP is backing Irvin?
No. Why would anybody be surprised by that?
Well, he told me he didn't. I go, well, why didn't you pick Sullivan? And he said, well, because of the stolen valor, and we don't like who's funding him. I'm like, okay. Why didn't you pick Darren Bailey? He said, well, he couldn't guarantee that our pensions were going to be there. And I said, well, then why did you pick Irvin? He's not a Democrat. Or, I'm sorry, he's a Democrat. He's not a Republican. And he said he used to serve as a police officer. No one candidate is perfect.
A police officer.
Candidate. You see, he served in the military. Sorry, excuse me. And he said he guaranteed their pensions. I'm like, okay, really? Mm-hmm.
The only people who are surprised that the FOP supported Irvin are people who know nothing about Illinois politics.
Well, I said
the only people who are surprised by the FOP endorsing Richard Irvin know nothing about Illinois Republican Party politics.
Well, I said, are you doing this to try to get to Ken Griffin's money? Because you're going to have a mayoral race. And he said, oh, no, I would never, ever, ever ask Richard Irvin to talk to Ken Griffin to give me money. Oh, no.
Well, you should, John, because that's the only person who can guarantee your police pensions. You clown. Guarantee police pensions. I can guarantee that math will not apply to this world. That's the sort of guarantee that you're banking on. How silly. How embarrassingly silly. The FOP, and like the Firefighters Union, routinely endorses these grifters in both parties, often Democrats over Republicans. They have for years.
The state FOP is not going to endorse anybody.
They're transactional. I'm sorry. You want to talk about law enforcement, the job they do. That's one topic of conversation. You want to talk about the associations and some of the people who've run them and some of the political decisions they've made. It's the same conversation as talking about a small business owner and talking about the Chamber of Commerce. the small business owner, I appreciate what the small business entrepreneur does, or even the big business entrepreneur does. The Chamber of Commerce is a political organization that's transactional and tries to read tea leaves and go wherever they can get their bread buttered, which is why you could have an Illinois Chamber of Commerce endorse a Dick Durbin, for example, which they've done before. How you can have a business group endorse a Dick Durbin for Senate, that's Illinois politics. How you can have an FOP endorse a grifter making promises they know are not worth the word spoken is Illinois politics. That means nothing, should be nothing to any informed voter. But I understand, unfortunately, because it's the only reason we're talking about Richard Ervin, there's a lot of low information voters in the Republican primary electorate in this state. We're about to see how many on June 28th. Richard Ervin served in the military and the federal prosecutor, the state prosecutor for a minute, most of his legal career as a criminal defense attorney, which is fine. But I mean, it's just being misrepresented as he's frickin' Elliot Ness. Of course it is. Can't even explain to you his position on the Foyd card.
No.
And can't even make an argument, whatever your position is, whether it should go or stay. He said, we need background checks. I know, so does every other state. Every federal firearm license dealer where you buy your guns does the background check and the National Institute check system, and that's how everybody gets background check, particularly those people in the 46 states that don't have Foyd cards. What else you got? Nothing. Because it's just about middling every issue, trying to be on all sides of every issue. He's a grifter. And by the way, this is a guy, if you know anybody in Aurora, which I do, including people who've served with him and people who've known him well. And by the way, I've known him for 15 years. You know, this is a guy who sees public office as his path to a lifestyle approximating the rich and famous. And that's how he's behaved as mayor.
Yeah,
and that's the story in the Tribune yesterday about this consultancy right. That he started with an employee that's a subordinate of his at the city of Aurora right now as a plan B, as a fallback plan if the political thing didn't work out for him because he's on the grift. And I have no problem with people making money. And I have no problem with people want to be consultants, make money in politics. I do have a problem if people want to leverage their office to make money. That's a different story. And that's what this guy does or is trying to do, has done and will do.
Yeah, he went into business with two guys from Virginia and then they got a $15,000 city contract.
I mean,
with their ties to
you
Urban.
Have to be willfully blind, deaf and dumb to not figure this out. This is so straightforward. And the $50 million. Funding the Richard Ervin blowtorch on the airwaves. All that's doing is amplifying how straightforward this is. If you're not being willfully blind, deaf, and dumb. Chris on the Dan Ryan.
Hey, Dan, hey, Amy. So the Foyd card started in 1967. Every time you reapply for the Foyd card, you also go through a state police check to make sure you don't have any outstanding warrants or anything like that. I have a Foyd card. I've had a Foyd card since I was 11 years old. And I'll be honest with you, when people talk about gun control and all this other stuff, you have to look at what they're talking about, right? They're talking about, I want gun control because people out there are stupid idiots and killing people. But you know what? Even though you're following the rules, paying your fees, you know, doing what you have to do, you should be punished. This is not the way to do it. Richard Ervin is an idiot. We all know that. And until the unions, and I mean this sincerely, until the unions stop backing these Democrat idiots, we're going to be all the way down the street with these guys all day long. And you know it, and I know it.
Thanks, Chris. Greg, Jefferson Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. Yeah, he's right, until the unions. But the unions ain't never going to do it because they all want their nice, big, fat, juicy pensions. You got the Northwest Side GOP up here, Matt Podgorski, and all the other idiots who are supporting Irvin, getting people putting out flyers and palm cards and making phone calls and everything else to get the word out to vote for this clown and the rest of the clowns that that they're doing. None of these people have any sincerity or integrity. It's absolutely astonishing. Get out of Illinois. See you guys.
Thanks, Greg. I mean, it's a real simple choice on June 28th. You either deliver, if you're a Republican, mm-hmm. you're a Republican primary voter, you either deliver a reckoning for the Republican Party, or you will continue to be delivered upon a reckoning from the Illinois political ruling class. That's the choice. Real simple.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. After a long... This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy.
I can't wait.
I love it when the left comes out of hiding and wants to have a bit of a street fight. They're used to fighting cake eaters on the right. Wrong address this time. John Chase, former Tribune reporter, Mark Jacob, former Tribune editor, and all these... dinosaurs from a bygone era in phony journalism coming forward and with their internet cowboy friends trying to suggest that the story about Oak Park River Forest race-based grading system is untrue and Oak Park River Forest denies it and no comment wasn't sought and so on and so forth. Thank you. Thank you for helping to shine a light on this because we'll just keep going. You keep swinging and I'll just continue to bring everything forward. They tried yesterday, I mentioned this,
yeah,
to quibble about this data point in the story detailing how minority students are going to be treated differently, no longer docked for missing class, misbehaving in school, or failing to turn in their assignments. This is something, by the way, that has been going on for a long time. It's just Oak Park River Forest got caught with their pants down more so than other school districts have. It's something called standards-based grading, which is not new. And it's not new at Oak Park River Forest. Actually, they announced they were adopting standards-based grading in 2015. For all you enterprising reporters out there, all you journalistic watchdogs, all you agenda-free arbiters of the truth that have chimed in, please call in. Won't you take me on straight away in real time with all this information that we have? Won't it be fun? The quibbling yesterday was about this data point, the OPRF failure rate for the SAT, sophomores who took the SAT. 77% for blacks, 49% for Hispanics, 27% for Asians, 25% for whites. Nobody fails the SAT. How do you have a failure rate for a test you can't fail? Boy, you got me, didn't you? Except the citation, in terms of the source of the information, is in the story, according to the Illinois State Board of Education.
Numbers don't lie.
Well, if they are, if they do lie, then take it up with the Illinois State Board of Education, because that's where we, because I'm part of this newspaper group, so as I've disclosed a kajillion times, that's where the I didn't write the story, but this is where the data was obtained, and the citation is in the story. And the Illinois State Board of Education website is about as clunky a website as currently exists on the internet. But I tweeted out the tabs that you go through. I screenshotted the Illinois State Standards.
Okay, to walk them through it. Yes.
So here are the Illinois State Standards. Here's what the color code means. The legend that's on the State Board of Education website. And you go through, you search for Oak Park High School, academic progress, SAT, demographics, and you see the numbers. And the characterization of failure rate is what they seized on because, yes, you technically you don't fail, but when the state says you're partially or not completely meeting state standards in terms of your score for sophomores taking the SAT, that's called failing. That's what failing is, not meeting the standard. So rather than spend any more time in the semantics, here's something else to consider. Maybe rather than arguing about wordsmithing, you might be more concerned about a failure rate, a fail to meet state standards rate, however you want to describe it. That's 77% for black sophomores at OPRF, 49% for Hispanics, 27% for Asians, 25% for whites. Maybe that's something that should be focused on. You know, the forest, not the twigs. I got some news.
What?
The Defense of Freedom Institute, because this thing doesn't exist. The race-based grading system doesn't exist. That's not what Oak Park River Force is doing. No, never talked about it. Don't know anything about it. Oh, okay.
They said it never happened at the May 26th meeting.
Never happened.
Never happened. That standard-based grading. No, no. Nothing is here, folks. That's the letter that they sent out to all the parents. And I talked to a parent yesterday from Oak Park River Forest, and she's thinking about moving her daughter out.
I mean,
because if this is real and this is true, and they're denying that it ever existed, but you're saying today that standard-based grading has been in OPRF since 2015.
I have so much in OPRF, I could do 4 hours in OPRF. Thank you for being the model of what everything that's wrong in K-12 education and in media and all, you know, all of these apparatchiks that rally to the defense of the identitarians in charge of that terrible, terrible, awful place. Oak Park River Forest High School. Awful place. Robert Itell was the chief counsel for Betsy DeVos when she was Secretary of Education. Now he runs, he's the president of, an organization called Defense of Freedom Institute. Yesterday, they sent a letter filing a complaint against Oak Park River Forest High School for their racially discriminatory grading system. This complaint sent to the Office of Civil Rights, the U.S. State Department, United States Department of Education. I tweeted out their press release at Dan Proft. If you want to see it, you can read the whole complaint. And I wish you would, because Bob Itell is a very good lawyer. And he's put together a very good complaint that also has all sorts of citations that all of you internet cowboys and willfully blind parents and identitarian hacks in Oak Park and River Forest can read. And if perhaps you don't understand it, we could explain it to you. If you don't want to understand it, well, that's your choice. That happened. Oh, by the way, Oak Park River Forest, they don't do any of this. What are you talking about? Standards. It's almost like you think racial equity is the only thing Oak Park River Forest focuses on. God, I know. Where would I get that? Maybe from their master plan. Master plan, this is just one page from the master plan at Oak Park River Forest High School. Things like fire suppressor sprinkler system in the auditorium. That was a 2022 project. Electrical power distribution upgrades. Resurfacing the tennis courts. Turf replacement of the south field. I'm reading from their master plan. One of the categories on the spreadsheet for every item, like those I just read, does it align with the strategic plan goal on racial equity? First and foremost. So let me give you an example. Resurfacing the tennis courts. Does resurfacing the tennis courts meet with the strategic plan goal on racial equity? No. Per student athletic data, tennis is a sport that has historically had higher levels of involvement, which is misspelled, from white students. Prioritizing, which is misspelled, courts is prioritizing the upgrade of the poor condition of the courts is necessary. That's sick. That's in is. I mean, it's typos, misspellings,
these grammatical errors.
Yeah, it's very impressive. Very impressive intellects over there. However, setting the tennis courts as priority would mean that we are prioritizing spaces that advantage white students over spaces that students of color occupy. Racial equity is not something they do. Separating kids by race, not something they do at Oak Park. You know, the place that had the black student assembly, black only student assembly, that place. They don't separate. What are you talking about? Standards based. I'm just making this stuff up, right? I've just made up this whole master plan from Oak Park River Forest High School. Turf replacement, South Field. Does that align with the strategic goal on racial equity? No. Per student athletic data, field hockey and lacrosse are sports that have traditionally had higher levels of participation for white students. The soccer has had a more diverse representation of the student body over time. The South Field upgrade is necessary for extracurricular sport and physical education classes. The upgrade, however, also prioritizes spaces that advantage white students over spaces that students of color occupy. Fire suppressor sprinkler system in the auditorium. Does it align with the strategic plan goal on racial equity? Is the fire suppressor sprinkler system in the auditorium racist, is the question that Oak Park River Forest administrators are asking.
Are they really asking
that? This is waving. Maybe this.
Show everybody in the Matrix Home Solutions studio.
Screenshot and put it out there for all these deep thinkers and journalistic standard bearers to pour over.
Is the sprinkler system
is
racist?
Is the sprinkler system at Oak Park River Forest racist? Does anybody at Oak Park River Forest know?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. And we'd love to hear from parents who send their kids there.
Yeah.
Because they want to look up in the auditorium and see racism.
Yeah, right.
That piece of metal, it's racist.
Is that fire sprinkler system looking at me? You eyeing me? Are you looking at me because I'm white? When it goes off.
Uh-oh.
Hey, are the white kids getting more water than the black kids? You'll know because they're separated by race in the auditorium, I presume. Pre-Brown v. Board, the model at Oak Park River Forest. Does the fire suppressor sprinkler system in the auditorium, the upgrade of it or fixing it, does that align with the strategic plan goal on racial equity?
Oh, my God.
You'll be happy to know, yes, it does.
Oh, okay, good.
There has been an intentional effort to seek out minority women and disadvantaged business enterprises in the bidding process and include in the pool for the capital improvement project. So that's how it becomes anti-racist, I guess. Remember, because you can't be not racist. That fire suppressor sprinkler system is either racist or it's anti-racist. Masonry and prep for roofing phase 2-4. Racist, not anti-racist. I mean, we could do this all day.
You said you have enough information for 4 hours. We should have started the show earlier.
We'll go into overtime. We're going to cut into Gallagher so I can read you more from Oak Park River Forest. I'm reading from their handbook, student handbook. Did I make this up, too?
Let's see the handbook. No, copy of it. Okay.
Got this. All right. There's the spreadsheets, all the racist fire sprinklers and whatnot. here's a priority. Okay. Priority 2, transformative education, which is exactly what was reported. And if you go through this, I won't go through it, but pages 47 to 58, read your own handbook at Oak Park River Forest. The parent student handbook or whatever they call it. I just gave you the pages because I've read them. It's racial equity all the time. Everything is about race and racial equity, which is essentially counting by race, differential treatment by race. That's what racial equity is. But you're telling me they don't do this. They don't do what they said. What we reported they do. Of course they do. They're just not used to getting any attention for doing it. Let me tell you something about the student-based grading, how it's been going on. This is from a piece last year by an English teacher named August Mayrad out of North Texas. He gives a great dissertation over at Quillette.com on standards-based grading, which is exactly what Oak Park Black Letter says they have adopted as their grading system. And they said it years ago. The new system known as standards-based grading or mastery-based grading, but it's a misnomer because it actually destroys standards and discourages mastery. It's not even grading. It's a way to avoid grading that allows for grade inflation, a dumbing down of classroom materials, and the elimination of accountability measures. You mean like turning in homework? Nevertheless, the theory has become reality, and progressive educators are insisting that it works just fine. And you have to go through the assumptions on which the standards-based grading is based in order to have a real appreciation for them. We'll go through them quickly just to give you a flavor. Standards-based grading assumes learning a concept or skill has nothing to do with independently completing work in a timely manner. Number two, standards-based grading assumes that a system of due dates and objective assignments unfairly favors certain students over others, as though some students simply can't comply on account of their race or class. Again, cut and paste, that's what Oak Park River Forest is doing. Third, standards-based grading assumes perfect cooperation from students. Given more time and less pressure, they'll turn in their work and learn the material eventually. And this requires that no students, this requires trust that no students will copy another's work or cheat in any way, which is wishful thinking, according to this teacher and according to any adult who knows anything about kids. But anyway, fourth, standards-based grading assumes perfect cooperation from teachers. Faced with the need to nag students for their work, assign tutorials, call home, alert counselors and administrators, and continually update their grades for every assignment, it will not be surprising if teachers decide to hold their nose and simply pass all their students. Sound familiar? And I'm not just talking about Oak Park River Forest. Finally, it's just bad pedagogy. It assumes academic disciplines can be broken into individual standards and that a teacher can isolate and assess independently. For instance, a typical standards-based English curriculum may call for students to master drawing inferences. But no matter how well the teacher designs and supervises an activity, determining how well a student demonstrates mastery of the standard is practically impossible. An ability to draw accurate inferences is directly tied to an ability to summarize details, determine a line of reasoning, discern an author's purpose, and so on. Reading comprehension is a complex process that defies an arbitrary breakdown of skills. I mean, that's just a quick summary of what's going on. And a quick summary of the lies that Oak Park River Forest and all of their defenders on the left are telling you. John in Oak Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan and Amy. 1983 graduate, four kids put through that school, and it's an absolute disgrace on what they're doing there. I went to that school, and during that black only student body assembly, and sat with Nate Rouse, who was the school principal, and told me, oh, they were going to do this for everybody. A bunch of frickin' lies. That school, that administration, is absolutely lying to everybody. I sent messages to the board member in regards to your broadcast a few days ago. Again, lies.
Yep.
It is an absolute disgusting thing that they're doing to that school. When I was there, it was you know, tops in the country, tops in the state, and here they are touting that they're 5%. They're in the top 5% of the nation. Oh, great. We're 863 out of 14,000 schools. What a crock of crap.
Thanks for the call, John, and I appreciate the passion, too. I feel, you know, the same way about my alma mater, Bennett Academy, that decided not to be a Catholic school anymore, that started dumbing down its diluting its academic standards, no longer pursuing academic excellence. It is. It's sad. It's sad that this generation of kids won't get the preparation that I got or that you got at OPRF when the schools were in the business of educating children and preparing them to be critical thinkers, independent thinkers, preparing them for college or the workforce.
And I think what's also disheartening is that they're still lying. That email that they sent out to all the parents saying, you know, this isn't happening, and that publication's not telling the truth.
Right.
I mean, they called out Westcook News.
Well, of course they did. And fine. Yeah. They need to, because this story has gone national. It's gone viral. And they need to, because the truth is, a lot of these Chardonnay Antifa out in Oak Park and River Forest, you know, they play along, but they're really not down with this. Especially when all of a sudden their kid is going to be negatively impacted.
Exactly.
Yeah. Here's an interesting comment from a parent on social media, rallying really to the defense of Westcook News. Sounds like a leftist who's skeptical of Westcook News and all this stuff. But nonetheless.
Let's hear it.
Another breach of trust from school. No, not because the school's elevated social justice above education, but again, because a few school ideologues believe their ideas are so good they shouldn't be vetted plainly and clearly with the community they swore to serve. Sound familiar, River Forest? This headline, the headline of the story in question, is getting a lot of clicks and not enough explanation. And I believe it's because OPRF High School is afraid to say it plain and simple. Pay close attention, read the books they cite, and yes, ask a kid what they prefer. They are switching from traditional rank grading with 0 to 100, 8F, penalties or praise for attendance, timeliness, participation, behavior, for a 1-4 grading system focused on Illinois state standards. Read up and you be the judge whether this is appropriate for high school or not. With a fancy name like equity-based grading, they were pandering to their union instead of being fair and honest with the community. That a paper like Westcook would take a semantic step is something we've grown accustomed to, but which local news source is really to blame here? We've seen it time and time again with District 90. Failure to comply with Illinois Open Meetings Act, failure to produce on simple FOIA requests at time when a few are changing what is taught, how it's taught, and when it's taught, and now how students are evaluated. Our own curriculum director said dropping A to F was misinformation, and they did it anyway. I understand job security, but do they really think this doesn't end bad for students? Be adults, be fair, return to putting kids first instead of your own ideas, and tell the darn truth in simple terms for moms and dads with busy lives and enough other worries on their minds. A return to transparency equals a return to trust. That is, you know, no conservative in the tank for me or for this show or for that news outlet. That's just a parent who sees what's actually happening in that school district and is inclined to be open-minded to their identitarian politics, which I'm not, of course, but it just shows you what's actually happening. And thus, Amy, as you pointed out, the need to send this email out to just do the categorical denial. Quickly, Mary Kay in Western Springs.
Yeah, well, I was at OPRF with Dick. John guy who you just talked to, 79 to 83. I got a big fat F in Latin when I took it for 6 weeks in the fall of 79. But that, you know, an F was an F, and it served me well because I got that F and I deserved that F. I didn't, LT, I talked to a mom from LT. I was chatting, I know, with somebody shocking. She told me, we discussed the whole racial thing, how that heaven beat the crap out of that kid, that freshman in the hallway, how disciplinary, the same thing at OPRF. They go into slots, same thing, Dan, you know, of course, you know, it's everywhere. It's happening at OPRF. Yeah.
Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. Yeah. But Mary Kay, you didn't fail, at least not in the modern parlance. You succeeded in not meeting the state standards. See, doesn't that sound better?
Well, that sounds better than an F.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and of course, as Roger Ayer calls it, the high holy month of pride. is off to a rousing start, as you would suggest, but I must offer a mea culpa.
Oh, really?
You know, I like to think we live in solidarity in North America with our Mexican friends to the south and our Canadian friends to the north. And so, you know, when they do something important.
The Canadians.
Step forward for civilization. Yeah, I'm talking about the Canadians in this instance.
Okay.
As Canadian MP Pam Damoff did, you know, I like to at least recognize it, observe it.
Because it could happen here, right?
Probably will. Yeah, the least I could do to...
what are you talking about?
Be an ally of that grade school drama teacher they made their PM, Justin Trudeau. Pam Damoff made this declaration. Now, this is the mea culpa is this was May 31st, and so I missed it.
Oh.
And you'll hear the declaration, and then if you would... maybe provide some advice and counsel on what I can get my broadcast partner here, Amy, for this special day, particularly since the gift will be belated.
A member for Oakville North Burlington.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Vaginas and vulvas are a source of strength, empowerment, and pleasure. Yet throughout our lives, we've been taught that the terms vulva and vagina do not have a place in polite conversation. That's one more way that the bodies of over half the world's population are stigmatized, sexualized, and objectified. With the recent news in the United States regarding Roe versus Wade, conversations about sexual and reproductive health are more important than ever, and it starts here on Parliament Hill. We need to reclaim space in health, research, politics, policy making at the doctor's office to celebrate the power of vulvas and vaginas. It's 2022 and we shouldn't be embarrassed or ashamed to talk about our bodies. Join me, the MPs from Winnipeg Centre, Sandwich Gulf Islands, Shefford, Senator McFedrin, and Action Canada as we jointly host a celebration on May 31st to reclaim the conversation and celebrate vulvas and vaginas as powerful and important.
Yeah, yes, yes, hear, 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 hear.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. What gift should I receive for that powerful day of the vulva and the vagina?
Think about how you can be an ally, that is the phraseology, in... celebrating the importance and what else did she say? Something
empowerment
else.
Empowerment, pleasure, and she's a whole bunch of gobbledygook in there.
The
pun now.
Intended. The importance of vulvas and vaginas. Speaking of celebrating body types.
Yes, and body parts.
And speaking of Rod Dreher, put a wiener on the Barbie. How about a wiener on the Bobby? Laverne Cox is the model for the new tranny Barbie.
Oh, from Orange is the New Black? That actress? Laverne Cox.
I don't know.
Okay.
Mattel offered this. Laverne Cox is award-winning actress, producer, writer, prominent LGBTQ plus advocate.
She's a great actress.
Proud to honor her in the Barbie tribute collection to help her amplify her message of moving beyond societal expectations to live more authentically. Authentically. So I suppose the tranny Barbie will be anatomical, even if it's not anatomically correct. For the first time, Ken doesn't get one, but tranny Barbie gets one. What do you think?
Instead of drag queens, they're drag kings now.
How about
coming out in Chicago?
How about celebrating? So if you want to celebrate vulvas and vaginas, what about celebrating, you know, Barbie with the penis grip?
I don't know, you'd put clothes on for that, but
Yeah,
put a wiener on the Barbie.
Mm-hmm. Hey, this is going on all over the place. Chicago Park District put out some collateral. What's going on this summer? May want to get the kids involved with. What do Peyton and Eli have going on?
They're
going
to work at Oak Street Beach and North Avenue Beach. Mm-hmm. Which scares me to death.
What about
arm them?
Were they going to be? Are they participating in queering the parks by chance?
Queering the parks?
Queering the parks is a youth-led initiative that creates uncontested public space by and for BIPOC and LGBTQIA plus youth ages 14 to 25, young adults.
Yeah.
Participate, sure. Queering the parks has engaged over 1,500 queer youth in community organizing, public programming, cultural production, and popular education. Queering the parks. Small as All. Small as All is a virtual youth programming centering on, you guessed it, BIPOC and LGBTQIA plus youth ages 10 to 15. Some overlap there. Your 14 and 15-year-olds can do both Small as All and Queering the Parks.
With 25-year-old men?
Hmm.
That sounds a little risky, but...
Okay. Small as All invites young people to deeply engage with nature and investigate the ecological and social relationships in the world around them, building on years of racial and environmental justice programming. Small as All supports young people in healing their relationships with one another and the natural world. Wonderful. Right? Yes?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. We got a... A lot of messages.
Here. Well, you also have, I mean, military. I don't want to leave our military out because...
I saw what the United States Marine Corps tweeted out.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I just don't...
The helmet with the rainbow-colored ammo.
Yeah.
The tips of the shells are different colors. The color of the LGBTQIA plus propaganda.
Who decided that we're all in?
U.S. Marine Corps tweeting out, throughout June, the USMC takes pride, hashtag, in recognizing and honoring the contributions of our LGBTQ service members. We remain committed to fostering an environment free from discrimination and defend the values of treating all equally with dignity and respect.
Putin. China loves those kind of tweets.
Yeah. The NSA.
Just stick to protecting us.
National Security Agency.
Oh, no. What
Happy
did they
Pride
do?
Month from the NSA. We're celebrating all the diverse voices that contribute to our mission because having pride in who you are and what you do, and apparently who you do it to, is intelligent. Because that's really important. Uh-huh. Homeland Security. Today we mark the beginning of Pride Month. Hashtag. During Pride, we recognize and celebrate the members of the LGBTQI+. What happened to A?
Homeland they forgot Security. A.
They
Uh-oh.
Forgot the A.
Uh-oh, now they've gone done it.
Somebody get Mayorkas on the phone. Get him on the blower.
Yeah, we don't care about the porous borders, but you got to put the A back in there, buddy.
He's going to be subject to that disinformation governance board if he's not careful.
She may sing to him.
That young man.
Mary Poppins lady.
Uh-huh. U.S. Air Force, happy Pride Month. We are the best. Hashtag USAF. By leveraging the diverse backgrounds and strengths of each member of our total force, we are committed to making the hashtag Air Force a place where we can all reach their full potential. Hashtag Pride. Hashtag Pride Month. And then you have a woman saluting and her hand and her arm are the rainbow colors. Wonderful. Wonderful graphic art.
We have a gift idea.
Oh, Pete in Montgomery.
Hey, Dan, you asked for a gift idea for Amy?
Yeah.
A family pack of Dental Dam.
Nice. So graphic, but I mean, how could it not be? Thanks for the call, Pete. You know, we
I got you the Gwyneth Paltrow vagina candle.
That is true.
Which I have in my house. That Maybe I'll true. Light it up tonight, huh?
And it wasn't even celebrating Women with Penises Day or some such thing that would have warranted gift giving. Not that I am one.
Right.
Oh, no. Yeah. But I mean, they're not going to celebrate Cisgendered White Male Day.
No.
So it'd have to be some other occasion.
Sorry. Yeah. You're not important.
No, I'm.
You've been canceled.
I'm well aware. Keith and Kankakee.
Yeah, good morning. The left reminds me of George Costanza in a Seinfeld episode where George takes Susan's parents out because he says he has a place in the Hamptons, even though her parents know he does not have a place, and George knows they know he does not have a place, but he just keeps going and going, and at some point he goes, you want to get nuts? Let's get nuts! They're just going as far as they can just to keep the train on the rails.
Thanks, Keith. Courtney and Kenosha.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment about the vulva and vagina freely expressing our sexuality all over the place.
Yeah.
Then how come we don't all walk around naked?
Why don't we?
What, let's just take away our clothes.
Well, if you want,
nothing's sacred anymore. Ourselves.
Yeah. Well, if you
exactly.
want to. Exactly. If you want to. Thanks for the call, Courtney. I mean.
Nothing's private anymore. Nothing.
There are no lines.
Talking
so,
about vajayjays. Give me a break.
You know, Courtney, you got to live your truth. You know, you got to be your authentic self. Like Mattel says, because if there's one thing a toy company knows, it's authenticity.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I want to continue rage against the dying of the Durham investigation in spite of the Sussman acquittal the other day. Just because you cannot let people get away with what Hillary Clinton and company have gotten away with, if not legally, than at least culturally and politically. So I was actually happy to see, I know he's on a book tour, but former Attorney General Bill Barr, he did Glenn Beck's podcast, and he talked about the Russian collusion hoax.
And?
Talking about also that sort of predicate for his characterization, talking about why he decided to go back and become Attorney General for the second time, even though it wasn't really something he had any intention of doing ever again. He did it because
I thought we were heading into a constitutional crisis. I think whatever you think of Trump, the fact is that the whole Russiagate thing was a grave injustice. It appears to be a dirty political trick that was used first to hobble him and then potentially to drive him from office.
Right. Does it rise to the level of the T word?
Treason?
I believe it is seditious, yes, and you know, whether that can be proved in court as a crime is one issue, but I think people are now coming to see what actually happened. People have to remember there's a difference between the standard you use in a criminal case,
correct,
which is the highest possible standard, and the standard of evidence that most people use in their daily life to make a judgment,
right,
which is much lower than
right.
that. It was a gross injustice. It hurt the United States in many ways, including what we're seeing in Ukraine these days. You know, it distorted our foreign policy and so forth. But I felt that the president was not getting his due as president. He was entitled, having won the election,
right,
to implement his administration, and they were, and you know, they had him on the ropes. And a lot of people, the regular bar, the lions of the bar and so forth, were not stepping forward.
Right.
And I tried to advance some other people to be attorney general. but none
George
of,
Washington tried that, too.
Yeah, but none were getting traction. And the question ultimately became, the president wants to talk to you. Are you willing to talk to him? And I wasn't going to do that unless I was willing to accept it if he offered it. And so I.
For more on this topic and several others, pleased to be joined again by Scott McKay, the publisher at The Hayride, contributor to The American Spectator. And he's got a book coming out. Well, look at him. He's all grown up now. He's all grown up. Look at what's...
And will you give him a write-up, please? On
Scott McKay, look at... he's all, so proud. It's going to be released on June 21st. The Revivalist
right.
Manifesto is the name of the book, Scott.
Yes, that's correct. Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. How are you guys doing?
Good morning. So what do you think about the Sussman verdict, the commentary from the likes of an Andy McCarthy and a Bill Barr about the importance of the prosecution, the importance of Sussman, the importance of the next prosecution up, Danchenko? And even with the acquittal, you still had a conviction of the FBI. You could read into that in part as a collaborator rather than a victim. And maybe that's in part why the jury didn't buy the charges that were leveled, the lie to the FBI charge leveled against Sussman.
Well, I think that's I guess that's the most optimistic interpretation of what happened. I mean, my take on it is that D.C., if you're gonna try a case that involves the federal government in any way, D.C. is a jury pool that is unacceptably bad. Because, like one of the jurors after the fact, I think, really kind of let the cat out of the bag, saying, oh, well, there's more important things than lying to the FBI.
Right.
Right. And it was like, okay, well, tell that to Mike Flynn. Right. Like, tell that to Scooter Libby.
Right.
Because, they would be really happy to hear it. And, I think it's okay if you're Michael Sussman that you can lie to the FBI, because the juries in D.C., and the thing is that jury pool was ridiculous. We had a juror who, his daughter was on like the swim team or whatever with Sussman's daughter. And you had people that were, AOC donors and DNC donors that were on the jury. You had somebody that said, they loathed Trump, but I could be objective about this. And I don't think that Durham's team is just incompetent at picking a jury. I think number one, you had a judge who basically rigged the trial in a number of different ways. But when you have a pool of people, 92.5% of which, vote Democrat in every single election, that makes it impossible to get an impartial jury. And the suggestion I would make, and I have two, and they're not mutually exclusive, one of which I did an American Spectator column on, is it's time to seriously look at moving all these federal agencies out of Washington altogether. Trump kind of dipped his toe in that water. I think he had the BLM that he was going to move to Grand Junction, Colorado, and he moved some of the U.S. Department of Agriculture offices to Kansas City. 6 out of every 7 federal employees, lives and works outside of Washington as it is. But the people who really count are the ones that are in Washington. And it's kind of time to move the generals to live among the troops.
Yeah,
because what you have is you have this beltway inside contempt for the rest of the country that I think was very evident in the Sussman jury. I think you need the draining the swamp means draining the agencies out of the swamp. But the other thing that I think could be done, which is maybe less drastic, is if you're going to try cases in D.C. federal district courts, you're going to need a national jury pool and not a D.C. jury pool.
Right. Well, that's going to be the same thing for Igor Danchenko, right? Isn't he, that trial going to be in Virginia and D.C. area?
Yeah, I think that was Northern District of Virginia, which might be a little better, but I'm not 100% sure about that. I'd have to go look that up to be.
Here's the larger point, though. Sussman should have been convicted. It's a slam dunk. I mean, they got him black letter on lying to the FBI. But Durham, to be fair to his team, they're sort of betwixt and between. I mean, it's hard to make a case just on a fairness argument as opposed to black letter law. This guy was a co-conspirator with this guy at the FBI, but he still technically lied to him. So technically you have to convict him for lying. So he had to sort of cast the FBI as a victim, or at least that was the choice he made. But the reality, the more, if we're not going to get up the food chain very far, the more what came out of the trial is really important culturally and politically. Robbie Mook's testimony that Hillary greenlighted it, whatever we're able to get from Danchenko. I mean, Sussman going away for 6 months and having a felony conviction and maybe losing his law license for a period of time. I mean, that would be nice. I appreciate a little bit of justice every now and again from our justice system. But the more enduring part of this will be a airtight argument that is completely supported by the evidence. As Ari Fleischer outlined on Special Report of the Prepared the other day, that this is how you manipulate the most powerful law enforcement agency and the intel agencies to weaponize them politically and get away with it, and that it was these principals that did what they did, and it was all illegitimate, and it was all lies, and these are bad people who did real lasting damage to this country. And if we can continue to remind people of that the way that the left is trying to, you know, character, the left characterizes 1-6 as an insurrection and then says it all the time, 24/7 for the next 10 years. That's what we should be doing about this. The difference is we have all the evidence on our side to make the characterization I just offered.
Yeah, I would say I agree with 100% of that. You know, what I want is somebody to be punished for it, right? Like, yeah, I mean, I, you know, more so than just, hey, let's have a great midterm election and, you know, put a bunch of Republicans in Congress. I mean, that, I think inflation should be enough to do that. So, you know, what I want is I want there to be consequences to these people. I mean, when you so egregiously corrupt our political process and the levers of our government, you know, to essentially destroy, at least for a couple of years, a duly elected president's administration that he has to deal with this, not to mention, what was it, 40 million, you know, of our tax dollars that were wasted in the Mueller investigation. I mean, I don't know whether we have to talk to a lawyer to see if this is even doable, but that's a class action lawsuit against Hillary Clinton. Right. You cost us this money. We want you to pay, say, 100,000 people that she's got to cut, you know, $40 checks apiece to.
We should hire,
and think what they did to Carter Page.
We should hire Johnny Depp's attorneys.
Oh, that's right.
To file that suit.
Yeah, they'd be good.
They look like they, I mean, they, you know, if they've got the work available, let's do it. I mean, the point is, needs to be a consequence for this kind of bad behavior, and the Clintons have been guilty of it for so long it's not even funny, and there's never been a consequence.
Well, what about Carter?
There's lots of consequences to the people that criticize them, and not good ones. But I would like to see something happen that would at least serve as an example. Hey, whatever you do, don't do what these guys did. And we're not at that point, which I think is a bad thing and needs to be fixed.
Could Carter Page file a lawsuit against Hillary Clinton?
I think they should.
He should.
I mean,
he had to sell his house.
Why not?
I mean, his life was hell. And I don't, you know, how is he going to get his reputation back?
Intentional. I mean, he could file IIED claim. I mean, there are other claims he could potentially make under color of law. Obviously, the big money is going to be from the lawsuits against the federal government, but she's got big money too. It's kind of interesting.
I would do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Not to mention going back and looking at the tweets, it could have a libel defamation claim too.
Well, quite possibly so. And I mean, it's, you know, this wasn't a negligence issue. I mean, this was done. Now we know this was done intentionally on her part. So, you know, people who are collateral victims of her trying to smear Trump as a Russian asset, I think you could probably get jurors sympathetic to a guy like Carter Page, who, you know, is not an elected official or a public figure of any kind. I would love to see something like that.
Let's talk a little gun violence. Unfortunately, we had another mass shooting yesterday in Tulsa with four people murdered at a medical office. This on the heels, obviously, of Uvalde and Buffalo. And you have some Republicans like Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson saying, yeah, maybe we should think about raising the age to buy a weapon or to buy a certain class of weapons, guns, to 21 years of age. You know, maybe we need to figure out a way to do something with congressional Democrats on this. What do you think?
I think, you know, we just make this assumption that November is going to be this big Republican rout. And the absolute best way to derail that would be for the Republican Party to abandon its voters on the Second Amendment. I mean, Republican voters are pretty much unanimous that we're not interested in giving away the store to the Democrats on gun control, particularly given the quality and character of this regime that is in control of the Democrat Party and right now the country, if you trust those people to respect your rights, if you're not an armed populace, then you are a moron. And most Republican voters are not morons. Mm-hmm. So, I wrote a thing in the American Spectator earlier this week. Do not mess with your voters if you want to win in November. You have got to hold the line on this. Don't do deals with Democrats, particularly not on. And this is something that always happens with sort of this, you know, Bush Republican stupid party, you know, political set, which is let's run and negotiate with ourselves to give the Democrats what they want. Like, what are you getting from the Democrats in order that you're now going to talk with them about, you know, gun control measures like, you know, more background checks or raising the age or, you know, like, what are you going to get in return for your own voters?
Well, for
yourself, right? Like, is there some grand bargain you're going to make, or are you just going to give things away to the Democrats?
Setting aside the electoral politics aspect of it, just the argument on the policy, in the measured words of Justin Trudeau, that drama teacher who's the Prime Minister of Canada, you know, we don't want guns to be a part of our daily lives, Scott. So what about that?
Okay. Well, I mean, if you don't want guns to be part of your daily life, then don't have a gun. I mean, it's not your decision if some guy who's willing to break the law is willing to break the law with a gun. I mean, you know, society is not, you can't pass a law to make that happen. You're not going to get all the guns off the street. And what Canada is going to find out is that it has a very long border, too, that people can run guns across. People ran whiskey across that border for, you know, God knows how many years, and nobody put a stop to it. So the idea that Canada is going to take all the guns off the streets, that's not going to happen. The criminals will have them whenever they want. And you know, as for this country, I mean, you can't keep the fentanyl off the streets, much less the guns.
Yeah.
So it's ridiculous to think that you could do anything along these lines.
Maybe I know the left in this country wants to follow Trudeau's lead on guns. Maybe they'll follow Trudeau's lead on fentanyl, too, and just decriminalize it.
Well, I mean, you know, at some point you start looking at the Democrat Party here in this country and, you know, Trudeau's party in Canada. It's like the dead baby party. Like, do everything you can to make sure that you know, society doesn't function in a manner that allows people to, you know, raise a family. So, you know, let's have all the fentanyl we want and no means of home protection, right? Like, how's that working in South Chicago, right? How's it working in Baltimore? I mean, I'm here in Baton Rouge, and this place is basically, you know, clown show murder town. And we're, you know, we're having a lot of gun control, but I mean, criminals can't get guns. Well, all the criminals have guns here, right? And everywhere else, that's true as well. Mm-hmm. So the idea that, you know, hey, we can make public policy to fix this. Tell you what, why don't you make public policy to fix the mental health problems you have in this country?
He is Scott.
Right?
He is Scott McKay, publisher at The Hayride, contributor to The Spectator, American Spectator, and his book coming out June 21st. Pre-order it. The Revivalist Manifesto. The Revivalist Manifesto. Scott McKay, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Amy. Have a good one.
Thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. What is a Christian to do with Pride Mania upon us, the High Holy Month of Pride, as Rod Dreher termed it?
Why don't we have a Jesus Month or something?
Carl Truman is a professor at Grove City College. He's also taught at Princeton. Pretty serious intellect. Contributor to First Things. Welcome to Pride Month, Christian, he writes. If the arrival of the Pilgrims, the founding of the nation, and even the contribution of Martin Luther King received no more than 24 hours on the national calendar, the LGBTQ+ Alliance has an entire month to party in the streets. It is an interesting juxtaposition. And this street party is enabled by the countless commercial ventures that post rainbow flags in their windows and on their websites. For anyone not completely hoodwinked by the erotic obsessions of our day, taking pride in one's sexual identity, indeed even considering sexual desire to be an identity, would seem at best pitiful and at worst a deep perversion of what it means to be human. Yet here we are, and we should not underestimate the power of what it signifies. It's a basic fact of history. If you control time and space, you control culture. And that's what they do. Control time, months, celebration, space, all over social media, businesses, parades, and so forth.
What adorns your house, your cars.
Yes.
It's everywhere.
The silver lining, mm-hmm. writes Professor Truman. Pride Month does offer those Christians who are passionate about social justice a chance to reassure those of us who fear their commitment to such is always tailored to appeal to the broader tastes of the day. For if Confederate flags and statues are deemed social justice issues by many, a point with which I'm sympathetic, he writes, how much more so is the rainbow flag? The use of the rainbow symbol should be particularly egregious to Christians. It is the primary instrument by which the LGBTQ plus movement asserts its ownership of the culture. And it's the means of telling those of us who dare to dissent that we should have no place in the public square anymore. It tears at God's creation order and design for family relations and social stability. It's also a blasphemous desecration of a sacred symbol, taking that which was intended as a sign of God's love and faithfulness and our dependence upon him, and turning it into an aggressive symbol of human autonomy and sexual decadence. Well, I guess Professor Truman won't be grand marshaling any pride parades this month, huh?
Mm-mm.
What about what he had to say for those who profess to be Christians? For more on this topic and others, I can't think of a representative of a better organization representing the Coalition for Canceled Priests. These are priests, Catholic priests, who've been canceled for, you know, being Catholic. Father John Lavelle joins us now. Father, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Amy, I just want to say we do have a month for Jesus. It is this month, which the Catholic Church has for centuries now dedicated to the Sacred Heart. And so I'm glad to join you in this month of the Sacred Heart to talk about the importance of standing up for our faith.
Mm.
That's good news.
Well, they got the rainbow flag, so I guess we can't use that, Father. So what about what Professor Truman had to say about this month in terms of what's being celebrated in our larger culture?
Well, you know, it's very interesting because I live in the south suburbs, and I was driving through Flossmoor yesterday, and all the flags, rainbow flags, are up. And what I notice is that it's a little bit different. They've been adding bars.
Yeah.
Colors yeah. to their rainbow flag because they want to incorporate the BLM movement in that as well. And what I'm just waiting for is for them to basically say, we're going to merge all these colors together, and it's going to be a red flag with a sickle on it. And because it's really Marxism that they're promoting. This is what they're doing
yeah.
at the expense of people. And I think as Christians, we need to take back the importance of this month for the Sacred Heart, but also take back that sacred symbol, which is the rainbow, and to show that it is God's sign through Noah to us that he will always protect us. You know, and we got to start proclaiming that in the public square. If we do not do that, okay, they're going to win every time. And that's what we're trying to do at the Coalition for Canceled Priests. We're trying to stand up for the faith, and we're being canceled by the PC culture that is in the church. You know, oftentimes people say to me, oh, well, you're canceled. You must have done something wrong. And I'm like, no, we're not. We're canceled because we're trying to stand up for what is right and to proclaim that truth, which is the love of Jesus Christ.
Well, just so you know, BLM is converting with LGBTQ because Juneteenth is, remember,
yes.
you know, that day. So for those of us who don't know, what exactly is a canceled priest? And can you tell us the details about why you were canceled?
So a canceled priest is basically an Orthodox priest, an Orthodox Catholic priest, who stands up for the truth, teaches on, you know, the so-called controversial issues like abortion, like homosexuality, on contraception, and stands up to teach what the faith is. And we're usually canceled because there is in the parish or in the diocese a Karen or Susan, as they're called, that gets offended, writes the bishop. Bishops across the country, sadly, especially in the last 20 years, do not see their priests as fellow co-workers. They see them as potential lawsuits. They see them as potential problems. And instead, they just want to remove those priests. And we're not removed at being canceled in any canonical way, the Code of Canon Law, which is the law of the church. We're just simply removed. In my case, I was removed in a non-penal, non-judicial way. When you discover what that phrase means, let me know, because it makes absolutely no sense. I've been canceled now. This July will be 10 years when my new bishop, the Bishop of Rockford, came in, and I still don't really know the reason why. What I do know is about 2 years before that, I was a whistleblower at a local Catholic high school that I was teaching at up in McHenry County, and I think it has something to do with that. And, of course, they're not going to come out and say, of course it has something to do with that. You shouldn't have done it.
And then,
but it's
then,
just putting the clues together.
Yeah, the nature of the whistleblower, whistleblower action, what did you report on?
I reported on that there was a female teacher, a lay teacher, who was inappropriately touching a female student. The female student reported it to me. And by law in the state of Illinois, I have to report that now. I mean, that we all teachers do.
Mm-hmm.
Catholic schools, public schools, it has to be reported. I reported on it. It became a very serious problem for the diocese and for the administration of the school. I was shortly thereafter removed from teaching there in the so-called normal transfers of priests and sent across the diocese. But, you know, that was more than likely what got the ball rolling, that I was seen as a problem because I want to stand up and defend the truth. And, by the way, defend children.
What is your perspective on what's happening within the church writ large in this country? And I say this in the context of some what I would call positive developments, like the Archbishop of San Francisco denying communion to Pelosi, just like Bishop Paprocki denied communion to Dick Durbin down in Springfield several years back. Is there a revolt going on within the church by Orthodox priests who want the Catholic Church to be about the catechism and not about social justice politics?
I would say that there is a revolt, but it's not coming from the Orthodox priests. It's coming from the clerics, especially the bishops, that are promoting this social justice type of mentality, which has been shoved down our throats now for decades. But in reality, we need to get back to the basics of our Catholic faith and teach that, because so many Catholics just simply don't know their faith anymore. And it just shouldn't be surprising to people that so many are leaving. And, you know, the Archbishop of San Francisco, Archbishop Corleone, one can make an honest assessment of basically saying it's about time. This should have been done years ago. And I don't want to make it look pessimistic when I say that. But at the same time, I want to stand up and defend Archbishop Corleone for finally doing the right thing and encouraging other bishops to follow his example. But they're not doing that. They're infighting amongst themselves. You see Cardinal Gregory in Washington, who is originally from Chicago, you know, basically saying, we're not going to stop Nancy Pelosi from receiving communion. And I find that just remarkable, because if the situation was reversed, Cardinal Gregory being on the more liberal side of things, you know, he would be throwing a fit right now if every bishop didn't agree with what he wanted to do when it comes to someone who lives in his diocese.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, here you have Cardinal Supich. This is a little bit insular, but it's indicative of something that's happening in the church writ large that you're discussing as well. Cardinal Supich attacking the Latin Mass and really essentially prohibiting the Latin Mass at churches like, St. John Cantius, where I go.
Yeah, so basically, the analogy to this is criticizing the tuning of the violins on the Titanic while the ship is sinking, okay? There is one growth in the church, albeit small, and that is in the traditional Latin Mass community. And within the last year, you see from the Vatican on down, you know, an attack on something that is good. You know, Pope Benedict made it quite clear 15 years ago that, you know, what earlier generations held as sacred is still sacred and holy and good for us today. Why is this a bad thing? Why are they attacking something that builds up the faith? It makes absolutely no sense, other than the fact that they're in line with, they do not care for what's described as traditional Catholicism. And that's one of the reasons why so many priests are being canceled, whether they say the traditional mass or the Novus Ordo mass, is because they want to stand up for the traditional values of our church. We are a traditional based church, and we need to get back to that.
Mm-hmm. And so when I was talking about a revolt within the church, I wasn't saying revolt by the social justice warriors. They're the ones in charge. I'm talking about, you know, I'm not the liberation theologists. I'm talking about, is there a revolt you see among parishioners or some cadre of priests against those modern day liberation theologists who are actually in charge of the church these days?
I would say yes, absolutely. If we're going to look at it in that way, you know, standing up for what is right, standing up for what the Holy Spirit, who in the end is the one in charge of the church, is basically saying enough is enough. We're tired of getting, as you say, this liberation theology, these heresies being shoved down our throats. We want Catholicism that is invigorating. We want Catholicism that is challenging to us, to make us better Christians and to make us better Catholics. You know, we're from Chicago. We're talking right now in Chicago. We see a great city on a decline simply because the church has taken a step back in its role. It was the church 100, 150 years ago in Chicago that built up this great city, and now we're seeing it turn into a sewer slowly, and the last few years especially, we see it accelerating, and we see no one in the church wanting to actually stand up for the values, those that are in charge, the leadership. They want to just basically placate the Democratic Party and then those in charge. And we need to get away from that and stand up and say no, like Bishop Athanasius 1600 years ago, and say, no, there's a problem here. We need to fight it. We need to stand up for what is right and for what the Holy Spirit is actually calling us to do.
And Canceled Priests, the website canceledpriests.org. You've got a one-year anniversary event coming up in Beloit, Wisconsin, just north of the Cheddar Curtain there. Thursday, June 23rd, all day Friday, June 24th, 23rd and 24th of this month. Finding Hope in the Desert is the name of your anniversary event. And you're also creating your own sort of conclave, if you will. You've got a property under contract in Cedar Lake, Indiana. So tell us about that event later this month and what you intend to do with this property you're developing in Northwest Indiana.
Oh, absolutely. So 1 year ago, we were founded because there was just too many priests in the Chicagoland area being canceled. We are not just a Midwest or Illinois-based organization. We're national. We're even helping priests internationally. And there is a rigorous background check that priests have to go through. It's all confidential. Again, that's on our website at canceledpriests.org. And we're having an event to basically celebrate our one-year anniversary. And you're absolutely right. It is called Finding Hope in the Desert because we want to look at the positive side of standing up for the Catholic faith and for Catholic teaching. We got some excellent Catholic speakers coming. Thursday night, we have Jesse Romero as our keynote at our banquet. And then we also have an all-day event on Friday. We have tickets on our website for those that are interested. And you can buy a ticket just for Friday, just for Thursday, or you can buy tickets for both. And a lot of people, especially from the Chicagoland area, are going, why Beloit, Wisconsin? Well, when we started planning for this, Illinois, especially Cook County, still had the draconian mask mandates and vaccine mandates. And so we thought it would be best to go outside the state of Illinois. And we found a great center, a convention center in Beloit, Wisconsin. When it comes to the property in Indiana, at the beginning of the year, we weren't looking for property. And then a famous archbishop who will remain nameless called me from Italy and said, Father, you need to find a home for these priests that don't have a home. I mean, right now we're actually paying rent for some priests to live in apartments across the country. And that same day, a friend of mine from high school, not knowing that I spoke to the archbishop, sent me a Zillow link for this old Franciscan friary And he said, wouldn't it be great to turn this into a boarding school, because he's a teacher. And I went to look at it, because Cedar Lake's only about 20 minutes from where I live now. And I was amazed at 61 acres, and we're hoping to revamp the building. It's structurally very sound, but needs a lot of cosmetic work on the inside, and make it a home for priests, but also make it a pilgrimage site. It's about 5 minutes from the Shrine of Christ's Passion, and we just want to restore the grottos and make it a place of pilgrimage, not only for priests, but for the laity, and possibly even turn part of the building into a retreat center for the laity to come as well, just so they can have spiritual renew. So when you say conclave, thank you for saying that, because it's going to be a house of refuge. I even call it a safe house.
I like that. Finding Hope in the Desert is the one-year anniversary event, June 23rd, June 24th, Beloit, Wisconsin. And get more information about the property that they're developing in Cedar Lake, Indiana, too. We get it all at canceledpriests.org, canceledpriests.org. Father John Lavelle, president and co-founder of the Coalition for Cancel the Priests. Thanks for joining us, Father. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. Have a great day.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Is there anything that more punctuates the vapidity of our politics than this idea politicians should get credit for standing in front of a microphone and saying we need to do something without having to explain what that something is?
What is the something you're talking about? That's what's been going on for 2 years.
We have to get together and do something.
We're going to form a committee, or I'm going to appoint this new person, this accomplished doctor from University of Chicago, to talk about mental health. Great. Well, what is she doing? What are you doing? That's the last press conference I was with Pritzker, because there was no answer.
Right. Doing something almost inevitably turns into some process that's going to be set up, some consortium that's going to be cobbled together, not anything particularly substantive on the topic. And this was the topic of Dan Henninger's most recent piece in the Wall Street Journal, which is why we invited him back to chat about it, because of its larger cultural implications, the just do something, anything to make us feel like we're doing something, anything, regardless of our ability to measure it or any prospect that it will improve the quality of life for anyone. Daniel Henninger is the deputy editor of the Wall Street Journal's editorial page. Dan, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you, Dan. Yeah, the calls for do something are everywhere now, related, you know, primarily to the shootings, which are just awful and terrible. And we're going to get into another big debate again about gun control. But yes, the political system always reacts in this way. They get in front of microphones. They start talking about what they're going to do. And if you look at history, it's pretty clear that when they do something like this, it leads to a morass of laws, rules, regulations, revisions of the revisions that eventually bog down any conceivable solution. I wrote a column 2 weeks ago after the Buffalo shooting about the problem of mental health. So many of these shooters are obviously deeply disturbed young men. And there has been some studies. I know that the Stanford Medical School did one recently. They looked at about 34 mass shooters over the last 20 years, concluded that 28 of them were getting no medication at all. And what I wrote about then was one of the great do something events about 3 decades ago was to deinstitutionalize the mentally ill, let them out of psychiatric hospitals and institutions. This is mostly in interest of their privacy. And the deal was that something would be created to provide them with community care, essentially that somehow outside these hospitals, they would be given their medications by a community care system. That never happened. It is one of the great catastrophes in public health. The homeless, many of the homeless you see on the street, often violent, or often the cases with these young men, are individuals who simply have no access to their medication, and their psychoses get worse.
Well, here is that
that was a tremendous failure of the do something impulse.
And that do something begot another do something that's been a tremendous failure, which is just medicate kids. And then we're just going to medicate kids. We're going to medicate our way out of the problem with Adderall and so on and so forth. And that masks what may be some other underlying characteristics that are common among some of these people that commit atrocities, which is isolation, loneliness, alienation. And you can't just medicate your way out of those feelings among testosterone-filled young men.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, I got a lot of emails on that column from individuals who've been through that problem, very frustrated, at treating their children, spouses, and so forth. And, you know, the issue I raised in my column, to do something column today, was I think, because of the system's tendency to do these sorts of things, we're heading towards a crisis of confidence in government. I mean, the political left is constantly, you know, protesting, saying the system, quote unquote, doesn't work for many people. Well, yeah, that's right. But have they ever stood back and looked at why the system doesn't work and what it has become, you know? Public schools, the healthcare system, criminal justice, mental health, as we've just been discussing. The reason so many of these institutions don't work is because they have become so encrusted with rules and regulation, and the people running those institutions are kind of in a state of gridlock, which we know, but my point is that I think we're getting to a juncture where the public is simply losing confidence in the ability of our system of government to provide the most basic responsibilities and services. And that's not a bad place to be.
Well, like baby formula shortage. I mean, this is exactly a serious issue. I knew we knew about this last February, and the Biden administration sat on their hands and did nothing, and now they're trying to play catch up. But also, President Biden said yesterday that there's nothing that he can do right now about high gas prices and food costs. And that's scary for a lot of Americans, especially those, you know, with the set budget that have to make sacrifices for their families in order to feed them.
Yeah, there's no question. And, you know, the Biden administration, the White House, is now continues to try to deflect responsibility for this inflation. They at least admit now they were wrong, that it was going to be transitory. But his argument, I think in some sense, at some level, it has to be taken seriously, because they're proposing an economic model and an economic future that the Democrats are insistent on trying to implement. And at its base, there is the belief now that no matter how much money the federal government spends, and then they have spent trillions, it won't cause inflation. They have a belief that this, you know, modern monetary theory, that as long as the government prints its own money, it can't cause inflation. And therefore, what we need to solve inflation is to pass this Build Back Better plan for healthcare, childcare, pre-education, because somehow transferring money to people will alleviate the cost of higher prices. To you or to me, that may sound like nonsense, but that is exactly what they believe.
And they also believe that all they have is a marketing problem. NBC News, in one of the more comedic pieces of reporting I've read in a while, Biden is pressing aides for a more compelling message and a sharper strategy while bristling at how they've tried to stifle the plain-speaking persona that has long been one of his most potent assets. I don't know that it's fair to characterize Biden as ever having a potent asset. But regardless, even in the present, the idea that it's just, as I said, it's just a marketing problem. It's not a results problem that they have.
Well, they seem to have both at the moment. I mean, the primary metric for measuring a presidential administration's performance is presidential approval, for better or worse. And this president's approval rating is below 40%. And Joe Biden is out there all the time talking in his quote-unquote plain-spoken way in front of the microphones, and it seems to have caused his approval to keep going straight down. And that usually translates into a catastrophe in the midterm elections for his own party. This is an administration and a president that badly needs a mid-course correction. But Joe Biden constantly is resentful when anybody suggests any such thing. This article suggests the same thing. What else can one say other that he's going to ride the current strategy right to the basement?
Yeah, like Slim Pickens and Dr. Strangelove. I wanted to get something else, though, in your column, I thought, and towards the end, it may be missed by some, because this is really an interesting point you make. Talk about Mick Mulvaney when he was director of OMB under Trump, and how, you know, out of any interest from the D.C. press corps, Mulvaney and OMB moved to make federal regulations in a range of sectors more rational and sensible, aligned with the interests of the American people and so forth. But that's the sort of unglamorous work that doesn't get any discussion, any debate, any measurement, because we're not fighting about guns or big tech companies or these other more sensational issues that are easier to sensationalize. But I just thought, you know, it'd be interesting to juxtapose something as seemingly mundane as the work Mulvaney did at OMB with all of the splashy virtue signaling Sunday talk show topics, and, you know, compare and contrast the results that the two parties have gotten for the American family.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, what I have wrote in this column is that people have reached a point of losing confidence in the system, and basically because the system is so built up with administrative sludge. And that was Mick Mulvaney's point, was to try to rationalize and reduce many of the federal rules to clear out the sludge. And I wrote, it's an irony, because believe it or not, back during Bill Clinton's presidency, he assigned Vice President Al Gore an assignment called Reinventing Government. And the point of reinventing government for Democrats back then, hard to believe, was to indeed rationalize and try to make government more efficient. But that effort was defeated by the big government Democrats. It went away, and the Democrats gave up on trying to make the bureaucracies in the administrative state work more efficiently. So it was left to all people, Donald Trump and his OMB director, Mick Mulvaney. And as I suggest, it is really the only real answer, Dan. We have got to make the system smaller than it is, or this crisis of confidence is simply going to keep growing.
Because it's unknowable, and then it just is perceived to be, rightly so in most instances, arbitrary.
Yeah, that's right. And people encounter that all the time. The Journal had a piece a week or so ago about people trying to get in touch with the Internal Revenue Service to solve problems. You can't do it. You can't even get hold of them. Medicare has been sending out notices to people saying the enrollment period for Medicare Part B is being extended, quote unquote, because you may not have been able to reach us by phone. at the edge of the cliff.
Yeah, those good examples. Dan Henninger, deputy editor of the Wall Street Journal's editorial page. Dan, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Great to talk to you guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Most recent reminder that the Biden family are a bunch of hillbilly grifters, starting with Hunter, who's financing the big guy and everybody else, so he says. A updated review of what was found on Hunter Biden's laptop, now that it's been confirmed by the New York Times that it's Hunter Biden's laptop. Thank you so much.
Oh, now that it's really a story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Please don't tell me it's pictures of his niece.
The Daily Mail reporting, Hunter Biden, who dated his late brother's wife, Hallie, had an obsession with, quote, MILF crack cocaine porn, lonely widows, and incest fantasies, according to his internet search history covering just 6 days in the March of 2019.
Just 6 days?
MILF crack cocaine porn, lonely widows, and incest fantasies.
Oh, God. I mean, he's
But now, to be fair, that was when he was back. That's March of 2019. He was at the tender age of 49 at the time.
So he should know right from wrong. He can't control his impulses.
Mm-hmm.
But yet his dad gave him a job where he made millions of dollars for the family.
The Daily Mail reporting, Hunter also loved filming himself banging prostitutes and then uploading them to his own Pornhub account, RH East. In one instance, Hunter texted a Pornhub page to a phone number saved in his contacts as dad, quote unquote. However, the Daily Mail points out that Hunter and Joe Biden used each other's phone numbers at various times, so it's unclear if the big guy was the intended recipient of whatever Pornhub content Hunter was sending out. Widow porn. Didn't know it was a thing.
Widow porn?
Widow porn. He searched Pornhub for videos involving widows, including, quote, homemade widow porn, homemade lonely widow porn, and lonely widow porn. There's a lot of subcategories. He also searched for porn involving teenagers, according to his browsing history. 18-year-olds and really good at writing blank. Teen Fidelity, Country Girl, Raylan Ann, blank pie. Lucky foreign students stripped and blanked by horny teen pals. This is his web browsing history.
This is devil's work here.
Mm-hmm.
And you think he's clean now?
Seven searches for Washington, D.C. MILF crack cocaine right before he dropped off the laptop for repair. Hunter's Pornhub stats show he watched 3,361 videos and had 24 subscribers and 66 friends. Boy, I'd love to meet his friends and subscribers.
How many hours? Over 3,000 hours?
He went under the name Pierre Delecto. Oh, no, that was Mitt Romney.
No, that's Mitt Romney.
He went under the name Harper, a 45-year-old single heterosexual male living in Gay Paris.
No, he didn't.
That was his handle.
Did he really say Gay Paris?
No, Paris.
Okay.
I'm just adding a little flair. Mm-hmm. And then there's also this business like he was spying on Haley. This is his brother's widow that he was dating because he was jealous that about the text messages she was receiving from some other dude and so on and so forth. It's all really
perverse and disgusting.
Yeah, it's like the Springer Show hillbilly stuff.
It's worse than that, though.
But it's, I mean, because I guess,
you know, his access, not to his father, but his father's money because companies wanted to use Hunter to get access to his dad. And this guy
Well,
he's the devil. I mean, he's obsessed.
Well, he's a train wreck, you know, and obviously that leaves the family in a compromising position. But I'm sure those Chinese communists and Ukrainian kleptocrats he's in business with have nothing but the best of intentions.
Oh, because he's such a brilliant mind.
And for Biden, the Biden family, and for America. Okay. Nothing to see here with Hunter Biden. By the way, that we ever going to get, just my latest check-in, are you going to get any high sign from the FBI about the state of that Hunter Biden investigation? Could we see a Hunter Biden indictment before the fall?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Well, that was just all a very salacious, lascivious way to get to the topic I actually wanted to get to. Since the Supreme Court temporarily blocked the Texas social media law that restricts the ability of Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube to moderate content on their platforms, they temporarily blocked it. Alito, Gorsuch, and Thomas dissenting with a majority that included ACB and Kavanaugh, saying that the case raises questions of importance and concerning a groundbreaking Texas law. Florida's got a similar one that addresses the power of dominant social media corporations to shape public discussion of the important issues of the day. And Alito's point was, I haven't decided on the merits of the law, but Texas shouldn't need Supreme Court preclearance before its law goes into effect. So this is still going to be adjudicated at some point in the near term. But for now, the big tech company has staved off the imposition of that law in Texas. And so the question about the propriety of what Texas and Florida have done with respect to social media companies. Give you an example of what concerns governors like Abbott and DeSantis and a lot of Republicans who are otherwise inclined to as free and open expression as possible, free from government interference. Sarah Wojcicki is the CEO of YouTube. She was at the Klaus Schwab Confab in Davos with our betters. And she had this to say about YouTube's censorship policies.
We're definitely investing a huge amount to make sure that we're fighting misinformation. And there are a number of different ways that we look at this. So the first would be from a policy standpoint, we would look at content that we would think about in terms of being violative of our policies. So if you look at COVID, for example, we came up with 10 different policies that we said would be violative. Like an example of that would be saying that COVID came from something other than a virus. And we did see people attacking 5G equipment, for example, because they thought that it was causing COVID. And so that would just be an example of a policy that we'd remove. So we do remove content based on those policies. We actually publish that in a transparency report. The second one would be really raising up authoritative information. So if you are dealing with a sensitive subject like news, health, science, we are going to make sure that what we're recommending is coming from a trusted, well-known publisher that can be reliable. And you know, if you think about how Google works, it's very similar. Like if you type in cancer or you type in COVID, what you're going to get are going to be names that you recognize. They're not going to be someone that just published a web page yesterday. So it's very similar with regard to how we handle that on YouTube. The third is making sure that we, if there's content that's borderline content that technically meets our policy but is lower quality, that's content that we basically will not recommend to our users. Our users could still access it, but they will not recommend it. And then lastly, we're just really careful about what we monetize. So we always want to make sure that there's no incentive. So, for example, with regard to climate change, we don't monetize any kind of climate change material. So there's no incentive for you to keep publishing that material that is propagating something that is generally understood as not accurate information.
Mm-hmm. Gene, nothing could go wrong with that paradigm for monitoring content at YouTube, right? So thus the law to protect viewpoint diversity on the social media platforms. This was the subject of a little debate that was had on NPR between Michigan State Law Professor Adam Candib and a general counsel for NetChoice, which is a social media association, advocacy association that is fighting these laws. First, the NetChoice general counsel, Carl Sabo, on why laws like those in Texas and Florida should not stand.
You know, what we're talking about here is actually pretty simple. It's about government, in this case, Republican government, forcing a private platform to say something it doesn't want to say. It would be like the government going into Chipotle and telling them that they have to serve hamburgers because people want hamburgers. And of course, that's absurd. So it's a really simple issue. Do we want, in this case, the Republican states of Texas and Florida to be able to tell private businesses that they have to host content that they don't want? And we're not just talking about political content. We're talking about lawful but awful content. We're talking about stuff like terrorist speech, terrorist recruitment, child grooming, foreign disinformation, a shooter's manifesto would still have to be required to be allowed on these platforms under these laws. And there's a reason why NetChoice is fighting against these. And it's because the First Amendment protects every person, every business from this type of government compelled speech. And it doesn't matter if you are like a cable company or an ISP, because the Supreme Court says even they are guaranteed these First Amendment protections and not have to carry speech that they don't want to carry. So really, it's a pretty simple issue. And there's a reason why we've had two district court judges, four circuit court judges, and at least five U.S. Supreme Court justices side with us every step of the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's failing to draw some lines that are certainly legitimately drawn, is Mr. Szabo, the NetChoice General Counsel. And this is where Michigan State Law Professor Adam Candib picks it up.
Platforms are free to censor dangerous content. They can censor and get rid of all sorts of undesirable content like nudity. What they can't do is censor whole viewpoints. So they can say no nudity on my platform, but they can't censor me if I want to be an advocate of the naturist lifestyle. And furthermore, getting back to Mr. Szabo's point, that's just absurd. I mean, the government requires businesses to host speech that they don't like in all sorts of instances. This television program is a good example. Local television broadcasters can compel cable systems to carry their channels and their programs. And the Supreme Court has upheld this. The Supreme Court and other courts have upheld the obligations of telephone companies to carry on their wires views they don't like. Similarly, in the network neutrality regulations, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia said ISPs must carry indiscriminately all sorts of messages. So this is just, this is smoke and mirrors saying now private businesses have some sort of First Amendment expressive right to exclude people. Restaurants don't have an expressive right to exclude Black people or Jewish people from their restaurants because they want to make a point. Similarly, the platforms, which again are the Supreme Court has called our public square, can't exclude people they don't like to make some obscure and not quite clear expressive point.
So to support those laws in Florida and Texas is not to say that there is no regulation that these private companies can impose on the content they allow on their platforms. For example, they can say to Hunter Biden, we don't want your smut being posted on our platform, as the professor was saying. So this debate will continue to rage on. And if Republicans do take control of the General Assembly, especially with the efforts that big tech companies make to insinuate themselves into electoral politics and put their finger on the scale for the left, it's going to be very interesting to see if they take up what has been modeled for them at the state level in Texas and Florida.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.